And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week on the show, we've got two topics to talk about. The first is endings. This week is, you know, part of the TV season. We've got a bunch of shows coming to a close, so we're going to talk about how you close out a show or a series of books or whatever else. Talk a little bit about how to say goodbye. We're also, because it's getting into summer, we never run out of summer topics that we love talking about, and today it's going to be road trips, specifically how we entertain and amuse ourselves on road trips. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do for NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I edit movies coverage for the website and, you know, little other things here and there.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, it's awfully good to see everybody. And as I said, our first topic this week is endings. Now, as we tape this podcast, for example, the last episode of House is scheduled to air tonight. There have been other shows, as we have mentioned in previous podcasts, that have gone off the air this year, Desperate Housewives and a few others. So we're thinking about finales. Now, what makes a good series finale, do you think?
It has to hit two spots because it has to satisfy the sort of visceral need for narrative closure.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be right there in the moment and it has to feel good. But it also, when I was thinking about the series finales that really stuck with me, there's a difference between whether or not it entertains you in the moment and satisfies you in the moment and then satisfies you upon reflection.
Right.
So there are several finales that really hit that sweet spot that were really satisfying in the moment. The first one I always think about is Six Feet Under.
Yeah.
Because it did something that a lot of finales do, which is to offer you a glimpse of the far future beyond the boundaries of that particular show. The other one that I thought really did it right was Star Trek The Next Generation, which also gave you glimpses of the future.
Mm-hmm.
That particular one also did what some good series finales do, which is it offered a mirror up to the first episode. The series finale of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, you're going to have to help me.
Yeah. Echoed a lot of the elements from the very first episode. And when it does that, you kind of see how much the show has grown from a very, very cheesy beginning to an entirely different kind of aged cheese at the end. And you can really see that that's really about the way the characters interact, and that feeds the body. It feeds the need for narrative closure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about you, Trey Graham? What do you think about series finales?
One of the classic episodes that wrapped up a show and sort of dispersed characters and so on was MASH, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was for a long time the most watched show on television. May still hold that record, I'm not sure.
I believe it has been surpassed by a couple of incredibly depressing things that do not come to mind.
Involving American
Idol.
Yeah,
but in terms of sheer numbers.
Like Joe Millionaire's finale.
Right. 70% of the people watching television watched that episode.
That's
crazy.
Yeah.
It's true.
And they did sort of take advantage of the natural ending, which was the end of the war.
Right, the end of the war. But I think Glenn's right. What Six Feet Under did that MASH didn't really was give you a sense of the shape of the lives of those characters,
right.
Not just their endings, but the sum of the corners they turned in their lives.
Right.
And it did it really economically, right? So that's always really satisfying to me.
Yeah. I mean, MASH does spend a fair amount of time going into sort of what's going to happen next for all of these people. And for a lot of them, it echoes what's always been most important to them. It echoes who they are in a way that feels logical and in some ways feels slightly surprising, but still in a way logical to those characters. For Charles to wind up interested in a band of musicians and things like that. I mean, that's all very logical.
There is something to be said for not putting a button on everything. The sense that you're leaving this enclave, this narrative, but and the creator is sort of setting those characters loose into the wild.
Right.
That their lives go on
while
you're not looking.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of, to me anyway, it's sort of the secret to a successful finale. I like, as a viewer, when a show sort of establishes, you know, there's sort of a natural endpoint here. Maybe there's an event, maybe there's a thing. But at the end of it, there's a sense that all of these lives that you've become attached to, or most of the lives that you've become attached to, go on.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the first thing that sprung to mind was not a TV show, but a comic strip, Calvin and Hobbes.
Sure, sure.
Where the final Calvin and Hobbes, there's a fresh blanket of snow, and Calvin and Hobbes are outside and sort of marveling at the wonder of it all. And the last line of the entire series is, "It's a magical world, Hobbes, old buddy. Let's go exploring."
Uh-huh.
And I just loved the way that you read that, and it sort of somehow ties up everything that strip stood for while allowing the reader to feel like it continues. There's not a sense like the strip ends with like Calvin Hobbes is now a depressed old man and he's somehow lost his beloved, you know. you know, we had a little discussion before this podcast about Barney Miller. And what happens at the end of Barney Miller is that basically the police station building is bought out and they are sent scattering.
Mm-hmm.
While it provides finality mm-hmm. and a huge hit spinoff in Fish, you don't sort of get to feel like these lives go on in this way that gave you comfort for seven or eight seasons. There's sort of this sense like, okay, now the story has ended.
Yep.
It's almost like if you move out of the house that you grew up in, you almost feel like no one else should live there.
Right.
And it's like people almost feel like if we're going to stop writing this show, then this world should kind of stop existing. Mm-hmm. So they have a tendency to kind of do that, to send everybody off to different places. Like in an ensemble cast, it'll be like, this person's going to go run for Congress. It will always be something that's theoretically good, so that you can have it be supposedly a happy ending. But I don't like those either. Those blow up the world.
So let's blow up Walnut Grove, for example.
Right.
Well, for some reason, what comes to mind is Who's the Boss, and I apologize. I don't know exactly why that is, but for some reason, you know, and they had the sort of like, we're going to move out of the house, and we're going to go do a different thing. And or maybe they stayed, but then they had left and come back. And there was a whole... Oh, no, it was Growing Pains where they left the house.
I knew it was something terrible. Linda watched so many of these.
I knew it was something terrible.
Did they turn out the lights at the end?
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, somebody always turns out the lights.
Somebody always turns
out
the lights. I don't think you can get away with that anymore.
You know, actually, I will say the one where they didn't turn out the lights, but I liked the final shot. Not necessarily the finale, but the final shot was Friends, where they had all their keys on the table. I thought that was a nice shot, despite the fact that I was never. I was always a person who thought the only brave choice that show could ever make was to
mass death,
burn the building down.
Was that if Ross and Rachel had been circling each other for that long, they're just not meant to be.
Right.
Just leave them apart.
I want to pose a question: are the rules different if we're talking comedy versus drama?
I think they somewhat are.
I think so. Yeah.
Or is the formula for what makes a satisfying ending?
Well, it was interesting because what Glenn said about having to hit two things, I sort of feel the same way. And I think we're saying kind of the same thing, but the way that I put those two things is, on the one hand, it has to wrap up the story in some kind of way. On the other hand, it needs to feel like the show. And the ones that I tend to not like are the ones that don't feel like the show.
Right. Seinfeld.
And the Seinfeld thing where it doesn't feel like an episode of the show. Now, Glenn has talked in the past a bunch of times. She loves the Seinfeld finale because it acknowledged that they're all horrible people, which I agree with 1,000%.
I get that point, but the episode doesn't have the right rhythm.
It's too stunty. It's too much, like you say, blowing up the world and all that.
Actually, as an aside, I interviewed Larry David in the AV Club a few months before that finale aired, and he just could not stop talking about how awesome it was and how much everyone was going to love it.
Yeah. Well, and some people did.
I could have warned
him. Some people did.
I am a fan of rug pulling. I love the ending of New Heart, which is that's very famous. At the end of the New Heart show, where he is the caretaker of an inn, he wakes up in bed with Suzanne Plachette, who was his co-star from the Bob Newhart show from the decade
before. They're in their bedroom with that furniture and all that.
And apparently, as soon as the curtain...
You get this gasp from the audience.
You do. As soon as the curtain is pulled and the lights come up, they recognize the set.
Well, they recognize the lamp.
Yeah.
She turns on the lamp, and it's that ugly plaid lamp. Yep. And as soon as they turn the lamp on, everybody goes, oh, because they get it. And in that one, I thought it was fine. But I will say, the famous St. Elsewhere ending,
where it's all
made up in the snow globe of the autistic child.
Kind of awesome.
Okay,
now you're going to tell me that Bobby stepping out of the shower was satisfying.
That's not the series finale.
Not the word that I was going to use was not awesome, because to me, that didn't say anything.
Yeah, people who talk about the snow globe ending, forget about the 50 minutes before the snow globe ending, when St. Allegius was closing and everybody got their little tied up little narrative threads, everybody focuses on the thing. But that was fun. That was so fun.
This is not what I expected from you. This is far more appetite for whimsy than I thought you had.
No, and it's not whimsy. It's kind of sad, actually. That's why I kind of liked it. Tragic and all these lives that you loved. And besides, they've set up that. This is an MTM show, and they set up that a long time with, they had one character who thinks he's in an episode of Mary Tyler Moore, and then whenever he sees Betty White come down the hall playing a different character, he goes, Sue Ann! You know, there was always that level to the show, so it just kind of made sense to me.
Well, having made this point about, on the one hand, it has to do the story, and on the other hand, it has to feel like the show, this is where I inevitably bring up the end of Lost, which I think cannot be left out of a thing like this. To me, I was not particularly happy with the story aspects, either of the entire last season or the specifics of the finale story.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think that final episode, and especially that final part that people hate, that sort of actual final 15 minutes or so, enormously feels to me like that show and like the ending that that show requires in an emotional sense. And I feel like it has this weird sort of thoughtful generosity toward the characters that was always what was underlying that show. And to me, it made a lot of sense that on the one hand, you have the story where a lot of people have to be sacrificed, essentially. But then they don't want to leave it on that kind of nihilistic. It's this sort of idea that you can't just kill everybody and only let like two or three people survive. And then
to go off and form Beverly Hills Bunts.
And then be like, that's the end.
Yeah.
So it has this weirdly satisfying segment that I like emotionally, even though I understand that it was flawed from a story perspective.
Okay, I talked before about the finales that satisfied sort of the bodily need for closure. Mm-hmm. And there are only two in the history of television that I think satisfy my sort of intellectual, emotionally. I'm talking about two shows. One called The Prisoner, a 1960s weird ass show, ostensibly about a spy who gets kidnapped and taken to a village, but that village isn't really an actual village, and there's all kinds of metaphorical things going on.
Didn't so you're M. Night Shyamalan make that movie?
No. You're led to believe all the way through this thing that you're going to get the answer to who runs the village, who is number one, and of course, at the end, because this is so voiced, this has such a singular presence behind it, you get some bat poop crazy stuff about what youth does and what authority means, and it's just crazy. And I loved it because it didn't answer the questions in the way you thought it answered the questions, but it answered some questions. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks got an ending that it deserved because, yes, there was an element to the show which is all about prosaic storylines, but mostly it was weird craziness on mainstream network television, stuff that shouldn't have been on mainstream network television. And that's what the finale hit, those crazy moments. There's a moment where little Jimmy Scott is singing Sycamore Trees, which is just the creepiest, weirdest thing you've ever seen at ABC at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday night or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are some who would argue that Twin Peaks and a few others sort of fall into the trap of raising a whole bunch of questions that they can't cash.
Right,
sure. To badly mix a metaphor. That there are certain shows where it's like, what will wrap up all these crazy threads? And the answer is,
nothing.
Yeah, exactly. The crazy show.
But I would argue that, when I'm talking about that voice behind it, that presence, you don't get the sense, at least if you do, you're wrong, that you're going to get prosaic little answers to every one of your questions. Right. Because David Lynch is not about giving you...
Tying up narrative loose ends.
It was the butler. No, it's about, it was the little man who was eating cream corn. There you go. Done. That's what you get. And if it works on this weird metaphorical dream logic level, which it does, I think that's all you need.
Well, and of course, in the case of Twin Peaks, they sort of had some sense, at least, that that was on the way out. So it sort of becomes a semi-completed work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we think it's different if it's abruptly canceled versus has time to play itself out, like Lost certainly did? Lost had multiple seasons, I think, after they knew exactly when it was ending.
Yeah, I mean, it's different in that it's immensely frustrating if you're one of the people who's actually invested in it. There was a high-profile NBC launch a few seasons ago called Kings, and I was trying to get into it. And, you know, it was heavily plotted, sort of based on stories from the Bible. The production values were really high, so I was kind of enjoying watching it. And then they pulled a plug on it, and right in the middle of a conspiracy plot, and, you know, very, very, very frustrating.
And now they have the ability sometimes to carry the rest of those episodes online for people who are really super into seeing what happened, and they've done that with something.
I felt that way about Pirate Master. when NBC canceled
Joke
Pirate
for five
Master.
People.
Yeah.
They do now have this habit with an increasing number of shows of announcing a renewal and at the same time saying this will be the last season.
Right, which gives the creators a lot more, you know, sort of
It gives
of
you an opportunity
headway.
To, it takes, I think, some of the pressure off of them to be working toward another renewal if everybody agrees that this is the appropriate time. They're doing it with 30 Rock. Mm-hmm. When 30 Rock comes back for another 13, that's going to be the final 13. They did it with Chuck, which was, again, another beloved show that kind of went through a lot of aggro every year about whether it was going to be renewed. And I think they sort of felt like it was smart to just let the creators have a season where everybody wasn't freaking out and everybody, this was going to be the end. And, you know, you were in some ways it's more pressure because everybody knows it's ending. But in another way, it's so much less pressure because you don't have to do the thing where you're writing something that might be the end of the show and you want to make sure that it's okay if it is the end of the show, and something that also might not be the end of the show and leaves you somewhere to go if it's not the end of the show. Friday Night Lights had that same thing. There were, I think, a couple of different points in Friday Night Lights where they were trying to make sure that if the only thing you ever saw of Friday Night Lights was the first season, that would be a completely satisfying TV show.
Well, yeah. And I think that in general, you talk about the difference between dramas and comedies. That's one area where I feel like dramas in particular are able to sort of set up each season as an arc.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of, within your larger story, you're able to tell a smaller story. I mean, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Friday Night Lights. Mm-hmm. If it does end when, you know, on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, they kill Glory or whatever, it could stand as, you know, as the end of the show if need be. And Buffy the Vampire Slayer in particular kind of has, at the end of season five, kind of is wrapping up the series. And then it's like, oh, wait, you know, here's season six and seven.
And I think it used to be more common, I think, than it is now, for people to make final episodes when they truly did not know that it was going to be the final episode. It feels to me now like with anything with any level of popularity, almost every series finale I can think of is written as a series finale.
Right.
For anything it's been on for any period of time. Obviously, it's not like, you know, they didn't know the third episode of The Playboy Club was going to be the last one ever aired.
Episode four of Hater.
Well, this is true for many comics as well. Sandman was a series that came into it thinking it was just going to go on forever. And then Gaiman said, you know what, I have an ending here. I have an ending in mind. And that series, I maintain, is one of the most complete. Because when you're just writing characters and you don't have an ending in mind, you flatten them. Because the thing that makes a story is an ending, giving it some kind of shape.
Yeah.
And that's what The Sandman did. And since Gaiman, other comics creators have come along who have said, I want to tell this story in 100 issues and 110 issues. This is one of the a really great series from the last few years, Why the Last Man by Brian K. Vaughan. Great series, but it knows exactly where it's going from the very beginning. There's not a lot of
there are great franchises where you might wish that the creator had taken that choice.
I mean,
he is a wonderful writer, but Armistead Maupin keeps going back to the Tales of the City universe. It's a universe I enjoy being in and catching up with those characters after decades. But sometimes, as you get more familiar with his rhythms and you see him do the same thing to characters over and over again, you sort of wish maybe the three books or the six books.
Yeah.
It's the difference between adventures and stories.
Yeah.
And for example, Superman is a character people just keep picking up and putting down because he's a corporate-owned property. So people just keep telling stories about him. And when a story really works is when somebody comes along, like Jerry Siegel in 1961 or Alan Moore in 1986, when they say, I'm going to tell the story of the death of Superman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do a homage to all of this history and show what happens when people pay homage to what this character means. When you give a character an ending, you give them purpose. Superhero comics are like this. Soap operas are like this. They just keep going on. The thing that pulls people in is this idea that tomorrow there'll be another chapter. And when you take that away, you all of a sudden make the characters resonate more.
So often it happens that TV shows last for so long that by the time there's a finale, nobody cares about it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at the list of shows that just ended. House, Desperate Housewives, One Tree Hill, CSI Miami, Chalk.
Didn't watch any of those.
But even if you take a show that had enormous impact early on, like ER, for example, by the time they had the ER finale, everybody was kind of like, oh, is that...
It almost felt like a reunion show.
Is that still on?
And they kind of did a stunt thing where everybody came back. And, you know, that was nice. That was fine. And people came back as long as they weren't dead. And to me, it's always sad when by the time the show is going off, they don't really get a chance for a proper ending.
Mm-hmm.
Because the life has sort of all drained out of it by that time anyway. And nobody really cares anymore. And so you're kind of stuck with these weird, you know, finales that don't really offer anything satisfying.
Well, and I think the saddest thing is every once in a while you do get a show that gets canceled right at the last minute, kind of after it's done being shot. I believe that happened with Benson, if you recall.
Maybe so.
That Benson, I'm pulling totally off of memory here, so but I believe that Benson sort of was canceled in the 11th hour, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, we just ended with
an
episode in which it might have even been and every once in a while.
Well,
it was a cliffhanger. Wasn't Benson was running against the governor or something like that.
And
it was some weird thing like that.
Mm.
Yeah, and you never find out who won or something.
This is a risk that comes with all creative endeavor, right? It's not just TV. It's not just book series. The opera Turandot doesn't have an ending because Puccini died right before he finished the final scene.
And there were supposed to be other girl with the dragon tattoo books envisioned as part of that series. That was envisioned as, I think, 10 or 6 or something like that. A substantially longer series.
So now everybody has to rely on my fan fiction.
Oh, God.
Well, and it is funny that we would
speaking of endings.
It is funny that we would be talking about this today. And the last thing that I will sort of say from my perspective about endings is that we're talking about this, and I wrote earlier today on the blog about Kristen Wiig's last episode on Saturday Night Live. And it got me thinking, although obviously series finales are very different from a send-off for a comedian on SNL, it really was a lovely little thing they did for her where sort of everyone danced with her. And it what it gave me the feeling of was how much I like to see something end well for someone, where their involvement in a project seems to come to an end in a way that they're happy with and that they feel good about, and where they can walk away from it feeling like, I had a good experience, and you sense that she's leaving, she's got other great opportunities, and this is a difficult week. Not to think, I like that very much more than what is happening with Dan Harmon and Community, not want to get into in detail because I don't know enough. Yeah. But the thing that is saddest to me about that is that no matter who's right and who's wrong and what happened, that just stinks. Because it's his baby and he loves it. And this is not the way you want that to end for anyone, no matter whether they kind of dug their own grave or not.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, you can Google it.
Absolutely. Dan Harmon, Community showrunner, recently fired from his own show going into its probably last season.
Yeah. Well, and I think in general, any sort of ending that comes with a whimper. And even if it's a show that you loved in the beginning that has sort of lost its bearings and is wheezing to a conclusion, if you ever had any passion for it, if you've ever admired the people involved, it's a sad thing.
And that's the other thread that you can tie to Community, is that I think there are a lot of people who are concerned that they're going to bring in other people, and it will kind of go through this fourth season, which is aimed at getting it enough episodes for syndication. But there are a lot of people who are sort of saying, you know, the last episode they just ran last week was good and strong and felt like that show, and you might want to think of that mentally as your series finale for the sake of sort of everyone's happiness. But we'll have to see what happened. They hired smart people, so we shall see, because you never know how an ending is going to turn out until it's already over, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Speaking of being already over, that brings us to the end of that segment.
Let's turn out the lights.
And now to continue the show.
We'll turn out the lights. So here's the thing. It's summer. Several of us are road trip people. I don't know how many of you are road trip people, but I, for one, once went west with my parents when I was 10. My sister was 13. We drove from Philadelphia out to California and then up the coast of California and camped the whole way.
I will be road tripping as you hear this.
We had one of those little pop-out we had one of those little pop-out trailers, and we camped the entire way, six weeks.
That's like, 2,500 miles with kids?
Are you kidding? 2,500 to go all the way out
each
to California?
Way.
And
each way.
Yeah, I mean, we put 10,000 miles on the car almost, because we drove all around and went to all the parks and stuff like that.
Let the record show that the grunts of horror, the groans of psychic pain are coming from Glenn Weldon.
Yeah, I bet you guys smelled great.
We were fine. Don't be mean. So as you can see, I am a very experienced road trip person. Stephen is also a guy who likes a road trip now and then.
No offense to my beloved children, but I do tend to favor road trips by myself.
You like the solo road trip. Okay, so when you are on a solo road trip, and that is not for the purpose of the rest of the segment. We're just going to say not any sort of euphemism or anything like that. When you are on a solo road trip, how do you amuse yourself?
How do I amuse myself?
See, now it sounds
by
dirty
solo road tripping.
Now it sounds dirty to you.
Well, one way that I was actually thinking about this segment, you know, when we were initially talking about it, was what do you do particularly for the road trip when you are with someone?
Oh, yeah.
And how different that is from a road trip. Because when you're by yourself, it's basically the equivalent of any, you know, if you are prone to exercise, which I am not, you sort of set up something that kind of goes well with your interior monologue.
Right.
As opposed to something.
Say for you, it would be crying.
For me, it would mostly be crying and eating sunflower seeds.
Nice.
but
see, here's the thing. Here's a byway we need to take is road trip food, right? Because I eat worse on a road trip than I would dream of eating on a road trip.
Well, so tell me, Stephen, when you are with another person on a road trip, what would a road trip with Stephen Thompson offer to our audience?
Oh, God.
Well, we talked about crying. No, I mean, I was actually reminded of a road trip that I took many, many years ago. It was right after college. I had to attend a conference in sunny Flint, Michigan, which entailed a road trip from Madison, Wisconsin to sunny Flint. And I was with a friend of mine named Sarah Strack. We took her pickup truck, and tucked in the dashboard of her pickup truck was a cassette copy of an album by a heavy metal band called Biohazard. Now, this was a wonderful road trip, and I remember we were absolutely tearing through the loop in Chicago at about 1 o'clock in the morning, blaring Biohazard's, I believe it's State of the World Address, you know, which, if I may emulate Biohazard, was basically... And I just want to put out there that when you are road tripping with someone, heavy metal... is kind of...
Now, see, the difference between Stephen Thompson and me, Trey Graham...
Everyone else here
is that...
Enumerate them alphabetically or by order of importance.
A friend and I once drove to the beach yowling along at the top of our lungs to the original cast recording of Sunday in the Park with George.
This is exactly what it was like.
I was hoarse the entire weekend, of course, because Mandy Patinkin's vocal lines tend to lie a little high. Mm. And the other guy now works in the White House, if you want to know what kind of people are running
Barack
the country.
His name is Barack Obama. I posit that this is not actually that different. What I'm saying about heavy metal is not you should always road trip with heavy metal. I'm saying if you have a sort of gigantically, theatrically massive piece of music that you can enjoy together and sort of, you know, the equivalent of like Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody or whatever, like a loud, familiar, silly, this is where I throw out two recommendations. One is Andrew WK's I Get Wet, which I talk about at every opportunity. It's one of my favorite albums. That is the album which has 11 songs, three of which contain the word party. Party, party till you puke, party hard, and it's time to party.
So
and
a trilogy then.
A trilogy. It's party trilogy, I call it. And it's just an absolutely fantastically wonderful, like overdriven. If you're driving someplace fast, if you need a jolt of energy, if you want some sort of sense that you are on an incredibly exciting, fun journey. If you are falling asleep, I recommend the album I Get Wet by Andrew WK. I also recommend an album that is coming out on June 5th that we will be previewing on our NPR Music website.
So you can't get it yet.
So you can't get it yet, but you will so soon. When this episode airs, it's going to be like 2 days later that you'll be able to hear a wonderfully titled album called Celebration Rock by a band called Japandroids.
Awesome.
Kind of a silly name for a band. The album is, it's 8 songs in 35 minutes, and it is just, it's two guys making so much noise for two guys. And there's a line in one of the songs that's like, we'll yell like hell to the heavens. It's just, that's just a perfect embodiment of how great it is.
It's funny that we should be talking about size and noise and spectacle and theatrical, because if you're on a serious long road trip, then like large scale works are fantastic.
Sure.
You know, I'm the opera nerd here, so I'm going to say, I will listen to an entire opera on a road trip. The Mahler Second Symphony, which is this massive thing that has little quiet parts, but also just thunderous. It's 100 people making a lot of noise, not 2 people.
Well, and anything like that that is, and you know, this is also true, obviously, of audiobooks, which are another obviously great
Which is
way
a thing
to...
that we've often talked about as, you know, a thing that makes time pass really quickly.
And, yeah, and if you're trying to make time pass quickly, that's a whole different story. But what you're talking about with operas is absolutely true of audiobooks. Anything that is sort of taking you on a journey through phases, and you can sort of almost mark time and mark off your trip based on the point in the story you are, that's a great example.
Have you noticed that if the book is too good, it doesn't make for a good audiobook? If the book is too much about its language, it doesn't make for necessarily a good audiobook? Hmm. Because I zone out. You zone out. When you're pulling up to a gas station, when you're pulling into a Hardee's, whatever the hell you do,
Hardee's.
Your attention... I just pulled.
Wow, Hardee's.
Your attention goes in and out.
More of a Culver's man myself.
We listened to Visit from the Goon Squad, a great book. Didn't work. Did not work
say,
as an audiobook.
Not that one I would expect would not work.
Well, not to get too inside baseball with life at NPR, but the first time I ever recorded a monologue for NPR, I had written this incredibly dense and flowery, clause-ridden, you know, in an essay like I would write for the website. And I was doing it for Morning Edition and went in and recorded it. And I was so happy. I was like, oh, this is so good. And read it out loud. Like, I realized as I was reading it that it was completely and utterly stultifying.
Yeah.
And I talked to Netta Ulaby on the NPR Arts desk and was sort of like, what's wrong with this piece? And I show it to her and she said, well, first thing you have to do is slay your dreaded enemy, the clause.
Yeah. Yep.
And that is the thing when you're talking about writing that is all about the intricate construction
the structure,
of language. An intricately constructed sentence is not going to track like something that your mind is going to be able to follow. It's just going to become this drone of words, sort of like what I'm doing right now.
What you need is a narrative that has mileposts along the way. Mm-hmm. If you can go with a mystery, you can go with a thriller. Even if the prose is crap, which, one of the things we like doing is picking up some mystery thriller. There's a medical examiner, and she's jetting off to Nantucket, and she's got her own...
And a cat is going to help her solve a mystery.
It's like... And so the clunkiness becomes a thing that you can enjoy together. Mm-hmm. And it's just about who's going to kill or be killed.
I love you and Faust united by mockery.
Yeah. Well, we made a deal long ago that the guy
with
who
Faust.
Is
Faust. He made a Faustian
bargain.
Made a deal that the guy who drives gets to control the tunes.
Oh, I see.
And I am not a strong driver, so I don't drive all that much. I'm a pedestrian and proud of it, which means that he gets control of the radio, which means that there's lots and lots of Latin power ballads. Mm-hmm. So then we negotiate sub-negotiations with, like, okay, we can listen to Latin music as long as they don't say the word corazón. And if he agrees to it...
You are narrowing it down.
He's an idiot, because there's like three songs that don't include corazón. But we like to listen to John Hodgman's books on tape, because it's not just him reading. He brings in Jonathan Coulton, and he does a lot of that. The same thing with the Daily Show books and the Colbert Report books. A lot of fun, because they're multimedia in a way. You know what's bad is Punch Buggy and Padiddle. Those are backseat games.
Padiddle. You don't distract the driver.
You don't punch the driver. We learned this the hard way. Punch Buggy, by the way, you see a Volkswagen Bug. Padiddle is, you see...
One headlight,
exactly. Sometimes I read short stories to him. I read The Great Gatsby to him, which you'd think... Which, again, to get to your point... to get to your point... Had to read the last sentence of The Great Gatsby like six times, because it is so beautiful, and it doesn't make sense unless you kind of, okay, well, let's diagram this.
The beating on part.
Theoretical question. Road trip music. Should it be familiar or unfamiliar?
Oh, definitely has to be familiar.
Well, it has to be familiar, and that's one of the reasons, a desire not to mess with the music and stuff like that is one of the reasons why I rarely listen to music on road trips. Mm-hmm. I am much more likely to listen to something spoken. And I say this as someone who just got back from a 10-hour road trip each way by myself, and pretty much, especially on the way back, pretty much just listen to episodes of Loveline. many of you know how much I love Dr. Drew, and I for a while I was out of love with that show when I got a chance to hear it. But I recently took the plunge and gave them $5 and got access to their archives. And so I downloaded a lot of episodes of Loveline. And so I have a lot of esoteric knowledge. If any of you need any,
because I just do a spin-off podcast.
You need a lot of advice.
I just listened to about 15 hours of Loveline. So,
can I be completely reactionary and suggest one final activity that might be interesting to undertake as you take a road trip with someone you know? Conversation.
Oh. No.
Overrated.
No, I would never do that.
This is one reason I travel alone.
There's something about sitting next to each other but not looking at each other that can open up a conversation in interesting ways, at least to me.
You know what? This is such a dude thing. And I'm going to say exactly what I'm talking about. One of my friends from college told me one time that both Nintendo and basketball hoops were invented so that men could talk about their feelings. And basically what you're saying is the same thing. Like, I don't want to be, like, talking to you, like, directly face-to-face like a person.
Exactly.
But I still want to talk about what I'm saying.
I can talk to your disembodied voice in the same room.
That's right.
I mean, two of the greatest conversations that I've ever had were with strangers on inadvertent road trips, where I got stuck in an airport and rented a car with someone.
The greatest conversations you've ever
Far
had.
Far better than any I've had with present company.
I was going to say.
Say the two only conversations I've ever enjoyed.
That's shocking.
But seriously, I've learned more about partners and parents on road trips.
Oh, it sounds
sitting
awful.
There.
Glenn's like, I would turn everything up to keep that from happening.
God.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I mean, I think it was a very important bonding experience with my family, that very, very long road trip, especially with my sister. I think it's one of the reasons why we like each other is that, you know, we kind of got all of the, you know, any irritation out of our system.
I think the reason my sister and I still like each other is because we didn't do that.
Anyway, so you should absolutely come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or find us on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And you can tell us about your road trip games. You know, come and find us. Tell us about what you like to do on road trips. Clean and happy stories and nasty, horrible stories are also welcome because, you know, who doesn't love a nasty, horrible road trip story? Well, and now we have arrived at our final segment, which is what is making us happy this week. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I'm going to switch it up and talk about a comedy podcast to this
time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I listen to a lot of comedy podcasts that come out of the Maximum Fun sort of network. Your Bullseyes, your Jordan Jesse Go, Stop Podcasting Yourself, Throwing Shade, Judge John Hodgman. These are all great. They're all very funny. There's one I've been avoiding because it's an advice podcast, and that sounds horrible to me. I'm a totally opposite you, Linda, to the idea of listening to somebody else's problems.
Loveline is meant for an adult audience.
Ugh. but it's a comedy advice podcast, and it's great. It's called My Brother and Me. It stars Justin McElroy, Travis McElroy, and Griffin McElroy, three brothers whose voices sound nothing alike, so you won't have any problem getting them confused. People.
you love opera, right?
Stop it. They basically just answer questions that people throw in, and it's not meant to be taken remotely seriously. They also have people write in. Are you guys familiar with Yahoo Answers? Do you know what Yahoo Answers
is? Yeah. Yeah.
I had no idea what this is, but apparently people just ask questions. It's mostly from...
If you Googled strange lumps and bumps for yourself, you would learn a lot about Yahoo
The people who ask questions in Yahoo Answers seem to be vacuous, blithely obnoxious teens who are trying to do homework. But so that's some of the questions that they ask. It's very funny. So check it out. My Brother and Me.
Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, one of the things that's making me happy this week is that we have a guest in the studio. One of my favorite NPR people, Jason DeRose, our West Coast bureau chief, is in town. And he was nodding wisely as Stephen was describing his misadventures in radio copywriting. Yeah. So that's fun. He's always a good guy to go to Real Happy Hour with. But what's making me happy this week officially is there is a 300-year-old play that is currently a gigantic hit in at least three cities. It's called A Servant of Two Masters. It's a classic commedia dell'arte. And here in D.C., it just opened at the Shakespeare Theater Company, which is also making me happy because it just won the Regional Tony Award. And in New York and London, A Servant for Two Masters has been adapted into a show called One Man, Two Governors, which is a gigantic hit. So this is me saying classical theater is good for you, but it is not spinach. It makes you smarter, but it is classic because it's freaking great. And you should see one of those shows or the other, if not both.
Absolutely outstanding. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, because I am contractually obligated as a member of this roundtable to shout out Margaret H. Wilson. You should point out that our pal Margaret H. Wilson has just gotten her master's degree in library science.
That's
and
awesome.
We love Margaret
Woo-hoo,
H. Wilson.
Librarians.
Awesome.
Thing two, Margaret H. Wilson will be visiting us next week. Love Margaret H. Wilson. Thing three, an incredible array of really fantastic records. Sigur Rós, Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, Regina Spektor and the Walkman, plus Saint Etienne, which I did not write the essay for. I highly recommend.
The Saint Etienne is, I haven't listened to the Spektor yet, but the Saint Etienne's terrific.
Oh my God, the Saint Etienne single tonight is so great. Yeah. Just a wonderful, wonderful song. Finally, I'm with Memorial Day weekend looming. I plan on going away for a little road trip, and I plan to take some of the advice, just a little getaway, during which I will do nothing but listen to music for work.
Awesome.
Spectacular. Great choices. Having talked already about Kristen Wiig on Saturday Night Live, I have kind of blown my what's making
I was really surprised you brought it up. I assumed that was going to be what's making
Yeah, it is. And so now I'm a little bit lost. And I can only mention two things that sort of violate what we like to call the Zaxxon rule. We like to make sure that the things that are making us happy this week are things that you can also enjoy and not merely things that made us personally happy. But I've already shared a bunch of things that you can enjoy. So now I'm going to share two things that you can't. One is that I had the opportunity to see some college friends this weekend who I have not seen in quite a long time, whose kids invented a game in which you take all of these states from a jigsaw puzzle of all the states. You take them, you put them in an old maple syrup bottle, all the ones that fit, you know, obvious ones like Indiana, Iowa, those will fit.
The Tennessee, your slender state.
Just not Texas, not Alaska, not the big ones. You put them all in a maple syrup container and then you shake it upside down and everyone has to guess which state will fall out last. Huh. And the adults in the room became surprisingly absorbed in trying to beat each other in guessing which state was going to fall out last. We learned that Florida is a good guess because it has a bend in it.
Yeah.
So it has a tendency to get stuck.
Sure.
Other good choices, anything that's barely fits in there.
I was going to say like an Ohio that's kind of square.
North Dakota.
Oh, sure.
North Dakota. So this was a very excellent game, and I thank their kids for inventing it and coming up with it.
Well, just for that, I'm sure that my kids are going to try that, but they're going to actually stuff the states in a bottle of full maple syrup. So thanks in advance.
And the other thing that I would mention is that I have successfully once again made a batch of corn dog mini muffins, which is Stephen's favorite thing in the world and which his kids also loved.
Why were they not in the newsroom today?
I ate them all.
Stephen and his kids ate them all. I have never seen those kids be so enthusiastic about anything I brought them in my entire life. They were both like, oh yeah, corn dog mini muffins. Boom. They were off.
There was a my son-shaped vapor trail.
Yeah, for those who missed the previous discussion of corn dog mini muffins.
I first made the corn dog mini muffins for the Super Bowl. And if you Google corn dog mini muffins,
it's now the first thing
you
that
can
comes
find
up.
The recipe is the first thing that comes up. And actually, they're quite popular. They are corn mini muffins with a little piece of hot dog in them. And they are super awesome. So I'm going to have to rely on those two things to be what's making me happy this week.
All right.
And that's our show. You can follow all of us.
Such as it is.
You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me in the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham, like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON, and listen to him attempt to finish writing his book. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are listening to right now. Thanks to all of you guys for being here to chat, as always.
Wouldn't miss it.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.